You're broken down and tired of living life on a merry-go-round. And you can't find a fighter, but I see it in you, so we gon' walk it out.
Hello, everybody, and thank you for tuning in to WOLB 1010 AM Talk Radio, featuring Team Radio Baltimore. This is Carol Mileta, your host of Parenting 411, where we share information parents need from sources they can trust. Today, we're going to take a look at something I've been speaking about quite a bit lately, communication with your kids. During these pandemic times, some parents have come to realize some gaps in communication with their children and want to work a little harder at it. Others who felt they were in pretty good shape with communication have relished these moments of increased togetherness and want to build even deeper connections. Wherever you fall on the spectrum, today's guest has lots of wisdom to share. I am so excited about it because it's sort of a full circle moment that I haven't shared with him yet. I am speaking of Trevor Romaine, author, illustrator, and speaker. For over 30 years, Trevor has been entertaining, educating, and inspiring both kids and adults with his best-selling books, award-winning animation series, and as a keynote speaker and incredible storyteller. He's written over 50 books that have sold more than 1 million copies worldwide and have been published in 22 different languages. Thousands of educators have used Trevor's materials as resources to help kids who are going through some pretty difficult life situations, such as bullying, divorce, deployment, grief trauma, and homework, just to name a few. The Washington Post says that Trevor's rapport with kids is a stunning thing to watch. He has traveled far and wide to share his encouraging messages with children and to bolster their confidence in expressing themselves. Let's welcome Trevor Romaine.
Oh, thank you so much. I can say right off the bat, I wish my dad was alive to have heard, he did hear it anyway, but to have heard what you said, because this teenager who had ADD and dyslexia, was very worried about me, and you just put his mind at rest, I can tell you that.
Oh, wow. I have no doubt he's looking down and is quite proud of his son. So tell us about the Trevor Romaine Company.
The Trevor Romaine Company, well, I interviewed for a job with a company called the Trevor Romaine Company, just so happened to have my name. That's what I always say. But the whole company really started early in the morning for me, so sometimes my humor doesn't work 100%. When I was a young person, I grew up in South Africa, and I was right in the thick of the apartheid era, which is one of the reasons I chose to move to the United States and become an American by choice. And I had an experience when I was in the South African Army, because we all had to, was compulsory to go and do army training. And one day I found myself in a hospital visiting a friend of mine who was injured. And I accidentally walked through the children's ward on my way to my friend's hospital. I'd lost my way. And I was walking through, and there happened to be a little boy, a little African boy, sitting on one of the edges of one of the beds. His legs had been very badly hurt. And as I walked past this 19-year-old soldier who thought, you know, he knew everything about the world, this little boy put his arms up towards me and asked me to hold him. And I happened to be the only adult in the room at the time. And I didn't know what to do. I looked around to see if I could find help for him, because obviously he needed it. And then he just reached even further and said, you know, please hold me. And so I put down my bag and I picked up this little boy. And I can tell you, I've never been held so tightly in my life. And this little kid put his face against my neck, and then he started to cry. He cried so hard that his tears ran down my cheek and my neck and into my shirt and touched my heart. And that's when my aha moment happened, although I didn't know it at the time, Carol, just that was the signal. And from that day onwards, I started thinking about kids and helping kids. And although that was when I was very young, the Trevor Romaine Company was born then, that seed was planted to try and help and serve children. And that's what I've done for the rest of my life and will do. Well,
we are so glad you followed your heart. And, you know, of course, I've read the book. And so you share that story in the book, but it just still is so touching just hearing you relay that for our listeners. Thank you so much for that. And so let's talk a little bit about your childhood relationships with adults and how they shape the books you decide to write, because you talk a bit about that in the book.
Yeah, I was very, very lucky, very lucky. And in fact, one of the best gifts I ever got in my whole life was time from my parents. That gave me the ability to share what was going on with me. My dad was very, very, very smart. He wasn't a very wealthy man. He was an artist. But I got more valuable gifts from him in his time than any financial gift could ever, you know, have come true for me. So what my dad would do was on Tuesday nights, was my time with him to have coffee. I had hot chocolate, he had coffee. My brother got the Wednesdays. And so my dad would sit with me, we would have our little coffee, and he would say things to me like, "Oh, you know, Mom and I had a fight the other night in front of you guys. I'm so sorry. We had a disagreement, and you know, I wish we hadn't have done that. I apologize." And then he said to me, "Well, I've made some extra money this year. Do you think we should all have a vacation, or should we build that playroom we're talking about?" Now, here this guy was asking me his, you know, for advice. And I thought, wow, he's asking my advice. So I gave him my advice. And then he'd say, "So what's on your mind?" And boy, I told him everything till the day he died, because he created that place where he heard me, and I respected that so much. And in turn, it gave me a channel to be able to safely, comfortably, and with love, share stuff with him, even if it was stuff that I was ashamed of or embarrassed. And it helped me so much, having the ear that he lent to us. And that really informed a lot of the way I grew up, because that taught me to be empathetic. And, you know, Brené Brown always talks about the difference between empathy and sympathy. And I must say that my dad opened those channels. And then my mom was very, very creative. And we would sit and create together, even if it was silly little lines or silly little characters. And the time they both gave me really was life-changing for me. And it set me up for what I've been doing and what I am doing today.
Yes, and listening to you, I mean, that quote that I've seen, and I'm sure you have too, where they say children spell love, T-I-M-E, really is true. And it's just so powerful what that does to a child, to feel invested in and to feel listened to and to hopefully feel known as a result of that time that they get to spend with their parents. So I really appreciate you talking about that.
Yeah.
Now, some adults, you know, parents struggle with how to do that. And, you know, and it requires us to be vulnerable, to stop and listen and be open to being changed by what our children have to say to us. So what do you think, are some things that kids wish that adults understood about how they could connect with them, about giving them what they need?
I love that question, because there are really three things, and I can come back to reminding you of them again later on. But so often we tell kids what we think they need to hear instead of listening to what they're asking for. And that's what kids, they want us to listen. You know, the first thing we do when a child is struggling with something, we say to them, "Don't worry, it's going to be fine. It's going to be fine." That makes you feel better that you've done something, but it doesn't help the child because it makes them feel alone. Because really what we're doing is negating their feelings. We're telling them, don't worry, it's going to be okay. When have you ever in your life ever not worried if somebody told you not to worry? So listening to what they're asking for, and sometimes they don't know how to ask you directly. Acting up sometimes, sometimes when somebody's looking really sad or doing something to get a reaction, they are, you know, trying really hard to ask you for something. So, you know, I've said so often to parents, just see if you can ask them directly, you know, what's going on. Like, why are you acting like this? Or is there something you'd like to share with me? And if you can create that in that safe place. The other thing, which is so vital, and I talk about this quite often in the books I write, is validating what a child is feeling. Because by letting them know you are in sync with what they are feeling, helps them to work with you through the feeling. I'll give you a perfect example. I happened to go with the United Nations at one point to the Congo, Uganda, Burundi, and Rwanda to work with former child soldiers. It was an incredible trip, and I was very blessed and so lucky to have been invited to go. And so what we did was we visited these refugee camps. We visited hospitals and orphanages. And we walked into one orphanage/refugee camp, and the kids came running. Now, every year I spend the month of December at an orphanage in South Africa. A friend of mine started it. There are 300 kids there. And the best thing in the world is when you get all these kids, they want to come and love on you and hug you and hold you. And so we walked into this refugee camp and the kids swarmed. You know, I had five kids on each arm and I was delighting in it. But all the workers around there were getting pretty perturbed because the kids were getting in the way of the United Nations contingency that was coming through. So one little boy, though, he was very clever. He put his finger through my belt loop, and he hung on for dear life. Probably 5-6-year-old little guy, big brown eyes, and I have such a memory of looking down and seeing those big eyes looking up at me, and oh, it warmed my heart so much to see this little face. Well, one of the workers came with a rolled up newspaper, and he swatted all the kids away. He said, go on, leave these people. They're important people. Leave them. And the little boy hung on with his belt loop, and I said, you know what? It's okay. Let him stay. It's fine. So this little boy walked around with me the whole day, his finger in my belt loop. I was drawing on the chalkboard in the classroom. He was hanging on, looking out at the class. At about 4 o'clock, we were gathering to have some tea and some water and stuff. And now, these kids were all orphans. They had no parents. A number of them had come from Rwanda. There were a lot of kids who were in ethnic fighting and cleansing had been brought here because they'd lost their parents. So at that time, the little boy pulls my sleeve and he wants to ask me a question. So I looked down at him, and through the translator, there was French, there's a little bit of English, a little bit of the colloquial language there. And so he wanted to ask me a question. So I said, okay. And I kneeled down because what I like to do is get on a child's eye level. And I share this with parents often. When we're looming over a child, especially a little one, and we are trying to ask them what's wrong, it's overpowering. So to be able to get on their level where we can be, mm-hmm. you know, in line with them, it helps them to feel more comfortable with us. So I get on the level of this little guy and I said, yes. So he asks me, can you help me find my mommy? Now, I knew that none of these kids had parents. And I was about to answer him when one of the workers came over and he said, don't worry. I told you we're going to find all your mommies one day. And I put up my hand to him and I said, stop. And I said to the little boy, where do you think your mommy is? And he said, oh, she died. She's in heaven. I said, oh, you know what? What I'm going to do tonight, because my daddy died, when I say my prayers and I speak to my dad, I'm going to tell him to look for your mom and tell her give her a message from you to tell her that you love her and that you miss her and you'll never forget her, okay? And this little boy was so relieved. He looked up at me and he hugged my leg and he said, thank you, mister, thank you so much. And he ran off to play soccer with the other kids and kept on waving at me so that I knew exactly where he was. But all he needed was validation. Not somebody lying to him and making stuff up to help him feel better in their mind. And so that's you know, one of the things I always share with adults is you know, try and validate what a child is feeling so then they can feel not alone in dealing and working through issues.
Yes, I agree with you. I think that's so important because, you know, especially when they're younger, those feelings, that's all they have. They don't have context and all of this other stuff. They just know what they feel deep down. And it really serves as a compass for them. And so for us to lie, as you said, or just to dismiss it, really is confusing for them. And, you know, later in life, when we really want them to be able to use their instincts, we will have, we really will have disrupted the development of that foundation for them if we don't validate their feelings as young people. So I really, I liked when you talked about that. Now,
could I just say one thing? Yeah, you know, one of the things is the way we get to be able to work through stuff is through experience. And you know, instead of pushing stuff aside, we've got to deal with stuff. And the more we help children deal with things so they feel supported, and if they go through something, that experience gives us the ability to deal with relationships, with jobs as we get older. Because we all run away from conflict and discomfort. But unless we actually address it and not push it aside, it's going to sit with us. And that experience of not dealing with things, we take with us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I absolutely agree. Now, I'm wondering how you have been working with children and organizations during the pandemic. What has that been like for you?
I had to adjust because I've spoken, oh goodness, in the last 10 to 12 years to over a million children at school assemblies. So I've traveled all over the world, I'm a 14-year-old trapped in an old dude's body. So mm-hmm. I connect with these kids when I go to their schools. But what we've had to do to adapt is do it online, you know, do some virtual school assemblies or school visits. I've done quite a lot of one-on-one with kids. I work with terminally ill kids a lot. And so I've had conversations with kids by phone and Zoom or Skype or whatever platform people are using. But I was determined not to let the pandemic break that connection that I have with these particular groups to be able to still be able to serve and help kids and just, you know, I've just found a different way around it instead of being blocked by it.
Mm-hmm. And so then it sounds like you're saying that you also speak to some groups on a recurring basis. So they know you. Is that what you're saying? Like some schools and some organizations, like you come back regularly with the children?
Yes. One of the things I've found too, especially working with children, is consistency helps children to trust the source of the information they're getting. And I, like the orphanage in South Africa that I go to, I Skype with them or Zoom with them, FaceTime them very often. And it's lovely to be able to not just come in there, do a rah-rah and leave. Now, because that's what happens often with kids is, you know, somebody will come in and be the hero for a few minutes and disappear, and then that's gone. So I feel that the continuity and maintaining our contact is really helpful because so often children, you know, kind of are set up with something and then that disappears and it's almost like they're being abandoned in a way. So I try to stay in contact with as many schools as I can. Obviously, it's difficult, especially when you see so many, but I think it's really important.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. Now, I'm wondering what your thoughts are on talking with children about the racial unrest in our country. And, you know, people in other countries are looking at what's going on here as well. And they've come out in support of it, I mean, in support of justice. And so I'm wondering how you talk to children. Have you had the occasion to talk to children about the racial unrest in our country? And also wondering how your message may be different, if it is, when you're talking to children of color versus non-black and brown children.
Oh, that's a fantastic question. And thank you so much for asking that, because so many people shy away from dealing with that situation. I've got to say right off the bat that I did leave South Africa because of the situation there. It was in the thick of apartheid. It was before Nelson Mandela was released. It was law that black people and white people were not allowed to be together. I found it disgusting. I found it uncomfortable. And I had experienced what hatred was like, because some of my family members, I'm Jewish, had been subjected to the Holocaust, and had been, and I mean, my wife's grandmother, two of the 11 sisters were able to come to the United States, and the other nine were perished in the camp. So, you know, understanding a little bit of what hatred feels like. So, but to my absolute surprise and dismay, when I got to the United States and thought I was coming to a place where there was no racism, I was in for a huge shock, because there was racism here. As much as I found there, except it wasn't law. It was swept under the carpet. It was inferred but unspoken most of the time. And so I started writing about it, and wrote a book called The Other Side of the Invisible Fence. And that's what I share with children a lot, is that there is an invisible barbed wire fence between people sometimes, and how to put a gate into that fence. What I share with children often too is that little kids, they have no conception of what nationality, what race, what color people are when they play together. And we learn hatred and we learn racism from the people around us. Because and as we grow older, sometimes people will mistake territorialism for choosing to be in a particular race. We all grow up in bands and groups, but I don't speak to any children differently, because I think that everybody needs to be treated equally. What I do, though, is, and sometimes I can see teachers squirming in their seats when I explain why I moved to the United States and that there is still a lot of hatred here. And what I say to children is that kindness is a superpower, and how being kind is the way we are going to be able to move forward, because we don't have to like everybody. Nobody likes everybody. But what we have to do is we have to respect people, and we have to realize that people are exactly the same as we are. We just have different influences. And to be able to understand that sometimes our parents might say something, and we don't have to trust or always go with what they are telling us. We need to think for ourselves. And if we think our parents are wrong, like racially, to be able to say something, even within a family group. And it's such a sensitive issue that I know when I do go to schools and I start talking about it, I can see those teachers getting really uncomfortable. But I believe it's my duty to be able to really talk about these very uncomfortable situations, especially when people are racist without sometimes even knowing it. So how do you investigate yourself to know if you are? And I've got to tell you that I had the privilege and the honor of meeting Nelson Mandela before he died. And Mr. Mandela said to me, when a person dies, their library of stories dies with them. So unless you can share your story by writing it down or telling somebody, other people can't benefit from what you've been through in your life. And there's a man who got out of jail after 27 years of breaking rocks and not coming out and wanting to kill everybody who put him there. And what we can learn from that man is that we can understand, respect, and connect with people of different color, different race, different nationality to us. And and he told me, when I shared some of my stories with him, he said, you know, your duty is to share those stories anytime you can. And who am I to ignore Nelson Mandela?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Wow. That's amazing. And just so such a blessing that you were able to meet him and just and hear those and many more words from him. Thank you for sharing that.
I just wanted to add one other thing. I have nephews who are black, two nephews, and my goodness me, these boys, 14 and 16, 17, boy, are they schooling me fantastically in what my perception is of where they are in their lives that I've only learned through the media and, you know, and through movies. It is wonderful, and I really respect them for calling me out on something that maybe, without me knowing at all, a phrase that I might use, or you know, something that can relate back to being racist. And I'm like, oh my goodness, I never in my life knew that. Mm-hmm. But them being brave and you know, strong enough and really with conviction saying, do you know what? That's not cool. And mm-hmm. that is one of the ways that I'm learning, by being open to what they're saying instead of being defensive about sharing information.
And that's valuable advice for parents as well, because when we don't want to respond, or we don't want to hear the questions or the observations that our children are making, even young children, you think you're not saying anything negative, so you're not causing any harm. But the idea that just the fact that you don't want to talk about certain things, or that you change the subject or whatever, that communicates to them that, oh, this is something bad, or, you know, this is just not something worth getting into. And so, you know, being open and just being willing to be educated by our children, who have so much wisdom. I mean, you know, it's unfiltered. So we certainly ought to tap into it.
When I talked about that time with my dad, you know, that's the kind of time you talk about that kind of stuff. What's amazing about talking to these boys is that what they are finding is that some people are genuinely interested in growing and being a better human beings and trying to, you know, not fit into, you know, pattern of being racist or even subconsciously. But also then they are getting what they've told me are the people who are doing the lip service. And they, when somebody says, wow, I'm colorblind, you know, that drives them mad. Because then they hear stuff and they're like, you know what, this person is absolute nonsense, because they are trying to, you know, just make me feel better. You know, when somebody says to them, oh, you know, I've got a black friend, and they're like, he said, you know, I can actually hear my own eyes rolling into the back of my head, because, you know, so that's it's very interesting when people are, you know, overly trying to placate, and they get into I'm perfect kind of situation.
So now I want to tell our listeners, first of all, I want to remind everyone, if you're just tuning in, that you're listening to WOLB 1010 AM. This is the Parenting 411 with Carol Mauletta, and I am interviewing Trevor Romaine. He is an author, illustrator, and champion of children, I'd say. And we are talking about communicating with children. And right now, I want to tell you all about his book, Connecting with Kids in a Disconnected World. You really want to pick this up. This is great. He has lots of stories and tips and ideas for you if you would really like to connect with a child in your life. And I want to tell you that this is really what I meant about the full circle moment, Trevor. So when I first talked with Alex from your staff, and he told me, you know, what you do and everything, and I said, wow, this sounds so familiar, because when my sons were younger, they are now young adults, I have twin sons, the first book I got from Free Spirit Publishing was Hands Are Not for Hitting, and that was written by Andre Agassi. And so I really liked the book. It was very easy for me to explain the concept in that book to the children because of the way the book is written. And so I noticed on the back of it, it says self-help for children. And so I went on to order several books from Free Spirit Publishing, and I think a couple might be your title. So a few of the books that I had included Stress Can Really Get on Your Nerves, Speak Up and Get Along. Now, that one's by Scott Cooper. And Bullying is a Pain in the Brain and Middle School Rules. And so it was just really just so wonderful to meet, to connect with you. And because those books were just, and books like them were just so powerful and really helped our children navigate, you know, challenging situations. So that's just another bonus in me meeting you.
Yes, that's lovely. Yes, Stress Can Really Get on Your Nerves. And Bullying is a Pain in the Brain. Free Spirit was so wonderful. I have always used humor to tackle even sometimes the most difficult situations. And so I did, How to Do Homework Without Throwing Up, and True or False Tests Stink. Even What on Earth Do You Do When Somebody Dies? Just taking serious issues that other people were running away from, and Free Spirit were really wonderful in allowing me to share these stories and my experiences. Yeah. Oh, that's a great. I'm so glad to hear that. You don't often hear about, as an author, readers, unless you sort of meet people who are at a book signing and what have you.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, no, I loved these books. And in my parenting workshops and classes, I talked about them all the time. I tell people to check them out. And so now I want our listeners to know that they can continue to read great books written by you at trevorromaine.com. And if you'd like to take a look at that while we're continuing our conversation out there. But now I want to talk about some of the things, some more things that you you describe in your book. And so talk about the power of storytelling in connecting with children.
Yes, storytelling for me has been probably one of the best mediums that I've been able to use to help validate what a child is feeling, and to be able to get across, an idea that when we sometimes tell kids stuff directly, they feel like they're being lectured to, that using a story as a metaphor sharing personal experiences. So when Nelson Mandela was talking about sharing stories, a lot of the stories came to mind that I have gone through and experienced in my life. And one of the things I tell children is, I tell parents, if your child is struggling with something, instead of saying to them, oh, I understand, because we can't understand what each individual child is going through because they are going through it themselves. To be able to share a story of something similar that you might have gone through, which they can then relate to, shows that you understand what they are experiencing. Although we don't tell children you understand, because that kind of sets them up a little bit. But I had an experience, the power of sharing stories. One of them, which I've shared with, oh goodness, probably the million children plus that I've spoken to, is an experience I had at the orphanage in South Africa. And this shows you how sharing one story can be passed on to other people to inspire and motivate them to change the world. So I happened to be at the orphanage one day when they have what they call Cookie Day. Once or twice a year, people bring cookies for the kids, and they get one cookie, only one, because there's just not enough to go around. And when you've got 300 kids waiting in line, they get their cookie. So I watched these kids, one at a time, grab the cookie. They gobbled that thing down so fast. Next person got their cookie, gobbled it down. Next person, and so on, except for one little boy. And I remember clearly he had a little orange hoodie on, and he seemed very subdued. All the other kids were bouncing up and down, excited about their cookie. This little boy, when he got his cookie, he sort of walked off to the side, and then instead of just gobbling it up, he looked at it for the longest time. Then he took that cookie, and he ate it exactly in half. He nibbled the edges, and he ate this little cookie. And I see him look around. He reaches into his pocket, and he pulled out a piece of school book paper. You know, the white paper with the blue lines? And he folded that half a cookie, and he made a perfect little packet, and he puts it into his pocket. So I went up to him, and I said to him, "Hey, buddy, didn't you like the cookie?" And he goes, no, Mr. Trevor, I love the cookie. It's the best cookie I ever tasted. It's got chocolate and nuts in it." I said, "Are you feeling sick?" He said, "No. Why?" I said, "I saw you put half a cookie in your pocket." "Oh, I know what you're doing. Tomorrow, nobody's going to have a cookie. You're going to take your cookie out and make them all jealous, right? I've got a cookie." He said, "No, sir, that's not why I saved it." I said, "Oh, so why did you save it?" He gives a big sigh, and he says to me, "Sir, it's because I'm very worried." I'm like, "What are you worried about, dude?" He goes, "Sir, I'm worried about my best friend." I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, about 2 weeks ago, my best friend, he came to this orphanage with me when we were little babies. We both don't have moms or dads, and we're both 9 years old, and we've grown up here together." He said, "But about 2 weeks ago, he couldn't wake up in the morning. And they came and they patted his face, and they put water on his face, and he couldn't wake up. So the ambulance had to come, and my friend is very, very sick. He's in the hospital. But I think maybe he's going to come home next week, or maybe in 2 weeks, and I'm saving half the cookie for him."
Mm.
And
beautiful.
Sharing, yeah. And, you know, I've told that story a million times, and I still get goosebumps. Because just by sharing that story and sharing the power of kindness, we can really connect with people we're sharing the story with. And they hopefully can take that story and share it with somebody else. And I have found that just by sharing stories, especially my own experiences, when I want to get a point across or share information, that kids and adults can connect and tap into the essence of what you're saying, and they can feel it instead of only just hearing or reading it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the power of storytelling is unbelievably remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
Really helps.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's something else that you shared where you talked about using objects to connect with kids. And I remembered where I did something similar to what you described. So my son was in preschool and very active, very inquisitive. And his teacher liked her class really calm. She's, you know, the boys, the high energy boys really were difficult for her. And so, she'd get frustrated with them. And then, you know, children take their cues from the adult in the room, right? So then, you know, so very often I felt like, I imagine that he just felt like he didn't have a friend in the classroom, and he'd be very frustrated. And so anyway, right about that time, Toy Story was popular. And so I created a little I used a poster board and laminated a little image of Woody, the character in the movie. And I wrote on the back, "You've got a friend in me," so that, and I, you know, I'd have him put it in his little pocket, you know, every day, so that he'd always remember that I was rooting for him and that he had a friend.
That's very powerful. You know, oftentimes kids need something physical to hold on to that can be a trigger to help them. Do I have a few minutes to tell a story that sort of resonates with
yes,
that?
Yes, absolutely.
Very powerful story. So I am known as the Doctor of Mischief in a number of hospitals because being a 14-year-old trapped in an old dude's body, I am immature. And when I get in there, I'm not afraid of being with a sick child, especially a terminally ill child. A lot of people run away. They can't cope with it. I've been very, very blessed that I was given not only the mission, but the ability to tolerate the discomfort of being with a child who may be dying. And one day I was at the hospital visiting a little guy named Victor. I think Victor was 12, 13 years old, somewhere around there. And we're sitting and we're having a chat about life and being silly, as usual, drawing in our journals and whatever. He turns around to me and says, "What's going to happen when I die?" I was about to answer him. His mother jumped off the bed, jumped off the chair, ran over to the bed and said, "You're not going to die. We have spent $375,000 to keep you alive. You will not die." So he goes, okay. You know, he behind his mother's back, he just pulls a tongue, you know, and rolls his eyes. Mm-hmm. Well, his mom left the room a few minutes later, and I said to him, you asked the question, you know, what do you mean? He goes, "No, what do you think is going to happen when I die?" I said, "Look, I believe we go to heaven. At least I hope so." And he goes, me too. I said, "Yeah, I think it's going to be pretty cool place." He goes, "But how do you know where to go when you get there?" I said, "What do you mean?" He goes, "Well, you know, like 1,000 people. There's about 1,000 people up there." I said, "No, there's millions, buddy." He goes, "Well, I said, "Look, hang on." He was getting all nervous about where to go and what to do. I said, "Hold on." And so I took a piece of paper out of my journal and I drew a picture of my grandfather. My grandfather died many years ago. Wonderful, warm, friendly guy. And like the drawing that you did, I decided to do him a drawing of my grandpa. So I drew a picture of my grandpa and I said, "This is my grandfather. His name is Ted." And I showed him the picture. I said, "When you memorize this picture, when you get up there, you go ask for him. He'll get you checked in. He'll get you a good room. He is an amazing guy." So he looks at the picture, he goes, "He looks nice. I'm going to tell him you said hi when I see him, okay?" I said, "Absolutely." So he puts the picture on the little pinning board next to the bed, right? And every day I go in there and I tease the poor guy and he points to the picture of my grandpa. He said, "I'm going to tell your grandpa that you teased me, okay?" I'm like, no, don't do that. Anyway, about 6 months later or so, unfortunately, he passed away. He just lost the battle. And his parents asked me if I would please come to the church and deliver the eulogy. Now, I'd never done a eulogy before, and I decided I was going to do a stand-up comedy routine to celebrate his death instead of, celebrate his life instead of mourning his death, rather. And so I went there, and unfortunately, it was an open casket ceremony. I'd never seen that before growing up in South Africa. I didn't want to look in the coffin. I wanted to remember that naughty little boy who was absolutely running wild in the hospital. So I didn't look. Went into the little chapel. They wheeled the coffin in, and they asked me to come up and deliver the eulogy. So I get up there, and I'm in my peripheral vision, I'm sensing the coffin, and it's open. They left it open inside. So I'm talking about Victor and the crazy things he did. Like one time he took his urine sample container, and he poured apple juice into it. And when the nurse came along and asked for his urine sample, he popped it open and he drank it. And she went berserk. So I'm sharing this at his funeral and everybody's laughing because they know that's the kind of thing he would do. And just drove everybody insane. So I'm laughing, everybody's laughing. And I said, you know, this little boy, he changed my life because he made me look at life differently. And I look over and I froze because there he was lying in the coffin. His hands were on his chest. Inside, he was wearing a black tuxedo with a red bow tie. His head was bald from the chemotherapy. He had all his toys in there from when he was a kid. His blankie, his baseball mitt and everything. And I'm so glad I looked because he looked so peaceful and comfortable and serene. And I knew he was okay. And you know what? He was lying there, Carolyn, in his hand. He was holding that picture of my grandfather.
Wow.
His mom. Yeah. His mom came up to me afterwards and said, you know, you did more for my child than $375,000. And I just smiled. But what I realized was that Victor needed somebody to be with him where he was on that journey, as opposed to telling him everything was going to be okay. And that is the power of sharing information and stories. And like the object you were talking about, that thing that you did for your kids, that is a very powerful way to help kids. I often draw on stones, little river stones. I do doodles, and I'll give it to kids whose parents are going through a deployment or kids who are going through a divorce to hold on to, so they've got something that can pull them to the place of safety emotionally by using a physical object.
I definitely believe in it. No doubt about it. Now, let's see, as we're winding down a little bit, I didn't get a chance to ask you because I don't recall it very much in your book, but what do you think about electronics and how does that line up with your vision with the ideal parent-child communication?
Look, electronics is something that's part of our future. It's never going to go away. And it can be a really good thing. I think that it just has to be regulated like anything else. If, you know, certain amount of time on it. And what I would do is use it as a connector too. Say, oh, let's do this together on on a device, or let's have a game night or a movie night where we can do it together. And I think, obviously, you know, this is a rabbit hole. Electronics are a rabbit hole where people can just get totally lost, obsessed, and addicted to being on devices. But I think as adults, we are role models. I've said it before, and I'll say it a million times again. When you are wanting special time with your child, leave the phone somewhere else. Don't even have it on your body. Don't even turn it off. Leave it, because it not only signals that you are in control of the device, it also lets kids know that they're getting 100% of your time. So I think it's really a matter of balance.
Absolutely. I agree with you. Now, we're coming to the weekend. So I'm wondering if you could tell our listeners three things they could do this weekend to improve connection with their children.
Okay. Well, you know, it's the three things I'd mentioned before. I'll mention again, and that's, you know, listen to what they're asking for, validate and create that communication space. But here's something that I think that you can try. Number one, share a story. Go back and remember a story that makes a huge impact on you as a young person, because kids love to hear their parents' stories. And we forget sometimes in the busyness of the world to actually sit down and have a story that's maybe not related or trying to teach them a lesson about something. You know, you can just say, oh, I just remember this thing happened to me when I was a kid. So share a story and then ask them to share a story that you may not know or have heard that they've talked about school or something. Number two is find time to be silly. We are this world is so serious and we are so stressed that doing silly stuff, you know, obviously I take that to the limit. You know, I always say, you know, silliness is something that helps me connect. But being silly or doing something silly together, like jumping around or dancing or, you know, just being silly. And the mm-hmm. other thing is that I suggest also doing chores together. So many kids say to me, you know, my kids, I just can't get them to do their homework. You know, and I'm watching the news and they're supposed to be doing their homework. So what I say to parents often is, do your homework with them. Or, you know, mm-hmm. like if you've got taxes to do, if you've got correspondence, do it while they're doing this. Also, do chores together as a team. You know, if you had to say, look, your room, you know what, let's do it. Let's go do your room together. And mm-hmm. create a team thing to do something that maybe they don't want to do or maybe even you're procrastinating about. So, hey, can you come help me? Let's do this. So those three things that might be something that they could do together. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Easy to do. So I hope you all who are listening will at least implement one of those things, if not all three, because they're great ideas. Now, I'm wondering, Trevor, can you tell us about anything new that you have coming up, any events or maybe new books or just anything that you might want to let our listeners know about and where they can get more information about it?
Yeah, I'm constantly working. I'm normally, because of my ADD growing up as a kid, I'm writing about that now. It was you know, very difficult, and being told I was a dreamer and didn't focus was difficult. So I'm writing about it now. There's a book that I'm working on that's got four sections. That I'm very excited about. There are four sayings that are the pillars of how I have built my career and my life, really. And the one pillar is little by little, a little becomes a lot, which is an African saying, which I love. Little by little, a little becomes a lot. The second mm-hmm. one is that nothing can grow in your comfort zone. So
yeah.
Sometimes we have to step out of it. The third one is that failure is not permanent. I always, we're so scared to try stuff because we're going to fail. And the last one, which is sort of the overview of the book, is don't let somebody dim your light simply because it's shining in their eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Don't let somebody mm-hmm. dim your light simply because it's shining in their eyes. So that is a book I'm working on for us to be able to you know, move forward. I work on little children's books all the time. I'm working on one about what happens when a parent gets very sick or terminally ill, or a grandparent, how to deal with that. So helping kids whose parents are ill. That's mm-hmm. next on the list. And then I'm doing a picture book just because I illustrate my own books about mice. It's a little known fact about imaginary. Yeah, it's called Little Known Fact About Imaginary Mice. I will send you that book.
Oh my goodness. Those creatures, I can't even stand them, even in cartoon form. thankfully I haven't seen many in real life, but they just, like in movies or something like that, they make my skin
yeah.
crawl.
Well, one of the reasons that I use mice in some of my stories, cartoon mice, and they're endearing. I make them look very, you know, very sweet. Is that when you use that? There's no race, there's no color, there's no, you know, anything that separates, you know, the particular mice that I draw. So kids of any color, any race can get the story, and not have to say, oh, that's a yellow mouse, that's a brown mouse, that's a black mouse, that's a white mouse.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a neutral mouse. So that just helps me to be able to reach more kids and not mm-hmm. get pigeonholed. But I think you will
wow,
like
that these. Sounds exciting. Okay, well, I will see. Now, I'm wondering about your book on ADD. Now, are you writing that on the level of the children's books that you write, or is that more of an adult book?
I am actually going to do companion books with this. I'm going to do
okay.
a book for adults and a book for kids. And there were just certain things that I learned and have learned along the way about dealing with my ADD. You know, I, for the longest time, Carol, I thought I was stupid because any time at school, if my foot was tapping, I got sent into the corner. I realized the way I got through school, and I'll tell you real quick, I could not remember anything. To this day, if I can't remember things. I did little drawings, little doodles. So if I had to remember the day somebody passed away, a figure in history like Nelson Mandela, I would draw a tombstone, draw the person's name on the tombstone, and draw a little bunch of flowers next to it, and then I would look at that picture. And I can remember those pictures for 20, 30 years. I could never remember a date otherwise. So I drew my way through school, but I drew in the margins of my books, and I got spanked for it. So I'm, you know, these are going to be tools for kids to be able to learn how to relax and chill and get information without letting it freak them out.
Okay, well, that would be very useful. I might have to have you come back on and talk about that one.
Would be love to do it.
Yes. So I want to remind our listeners that if you would like to keep up with the things that I'm doing, follow me at the Parenting 411 on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. And don't forget my upcoming book, Mother's Work, Pearls of Wisdom and Gems from My Journey, will be releasing on May 18th. So again, please follow me on my platform at the Parenting 411 on social media to get the details. And if you would like to pick up a copy of the book, you can visit carolmaletta.com/mothers work. And I look forward to talking to you all soon. Our next show is going to be pretty exciting, pretty fun. So don't forget to join me. And I look forward to talking to you soon. And Trevor, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I respect what you're doing and love it.
All right. Thank you.